executives.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a partner?
Yes, I do.
All right, okay. Yep, so then just email me in there. Yep. All right, good morning. Good morning. All right, so let's start off with the question or two. Anybody has a question or two? Even one? No. Nothing about the practical? Okay. Well, at the end of the last lecture, we were looking at a family of moments, moment invariants. So we do have a question. Okay, yeah.
Just ask a question. If you have a set of frames and an object is in one of the frames for a large proportion of them, then if you average, you take the median of those frames, that object's still going to be there. How would you deal with that?
How would I deal with that? Okay, so the question is really about how do you build up a background image, or alternatively, how do you update the background as time goes on when you're doing video surveillance? And the proposal was is that you use an average of a bunch of the frames together or do the median of a bunch of frames together as a way of estimating the background. Well, the two are slightly different. So the if you can imagine with the, suppose you just have an object quickly moving through the scene. Okay, if you do the average, then at every pixel where that object was, you're going to have a little bit of the average of the view of that pixel, or of that object. So even though you're doing sort of recursive averaging, you'll always have a little bit of that object left over. So averaging in is not a particularly great thing to do. Although people do it for a reason I'll come to in a minute. Alternatively, you can use a median, which says, okay, at a given pixel, I will look at the last 100 frames, and I will take the median value of that rather than the average value. Okay, and the assumption there is that if an object is moving through the scene, it will overlap that pixel maybe for a few frames, say 10 out of the 100. Okay, but if you're doing the median looks for the middle value, not the average value. And so 90 of those frames will be of the background, and 10 of those frames will be of the object that's in the foreground. So if you do the median, well, the middle value will be one of the background pixels. Okay, so why people do averaging is because if you want to do this median filter kind of thing, then you need to, if you want to have it go back over 100 frames, you need to store 100 frames of video, and then you need to process that 100 frames of video, and that can be quite time consuming. So often people use a recursive averaging sort of filter where you take some percentage of the current frame and some percentage of the previous average, and you combine them, and then that gives you your new average. And the net result is that if new objects move into the scene, they tend to get averaged in, particularly if they stay in one place for a long time, and then they sort of average in. Now, some people might like that. If you're doing observations of a car park when a car pulls in, once it sits there for a while, then you probably want to add it into the background average. Another way that people get around it, the problem of averaging moving objects into the background, is you just say, well, if an object has just appeared, then we don't average it into the background. We choose which pixels of the foreground to average, which pixels from the new frame to average into the background. If we've just detected a new object, we say, oh, well, we don't want to average that one into the background because it's a new object. It may just move on. Is that? Yeah.
So would averaging then also be better for, say, a background with, like, a plant is something that's moving in a slight breeze?
Okay, so the question is, what happens if you have, like, some object in the background that's, say, moving back and forth, like a plant in the breeze, or a tree, or, you know, fronds under the sea, or something like that? And averaging certainly could do that, but it's not going to give you a very good model of the background. It'll give you a kind of blurred model of the background. And what people tend to use is what's called a particle model, or something like that. Rather than keeping one model of the background, you'll maybe keep 100 models of the background, or some kind of statistical distribution of that. We'll talk a little bit more about that if any of you take the Advanced Vision course. In the second semester, we talk a bit more about these particle models. But the general idea is, rather than keeping one model of the background, you keep multiple models of the background. And then if you see this plant moving around in front of it, then you can say, well, is it one of my background models? In which case, then I ignore it as a bit of a background. Yeah.
So just taking an extreme example, if you had an object that was stationary and a port that was stationary and then moved through, that was stationary, say, for maybe and then for like five started movements. How would you
deal with that? Well, so this is a problem that you. Okay, so the question is, what happens if you know, you're watching some object which is stationary for a long period of time, and then it starts to move? How do you update your background for that? And well, and this is a real problem. So if you're doing surveillance of a car park, you know, a car drives in, okay, and then it becomes stationary for a long period of time, and then it becomes unstationary as whatever person drives off in the car. And this is a real problem that people who build automatic surveillance systems have to deal with. And we're sort of reaching the territory where, rather than doing sort of general image processing techniques, you have to start building special purpose algorithms that can cope with the particular kind of characteristics of your problem. Okay, so something like that, you might reason, say, well, this is a car park surveillance, you know, program or whatever, and it will know that cars do drive off, and therefore it will say, okay, when I detect what seems to be a car which is driving off, it's big, it's moving away, then I have to update the background right away with something new. Sort of special purpose reasoning there. Right, any other questions here? Okay, so I was saying at the end of the last lecture, we're starting to build up a set of descriptions about objects so that we can use to recognize them. And one of the families of descriptions were these so-called rotation invariant moments. So these are our essential moments. So that means that they're invariant to translation. We divided by a function of the area, and that made them scale invariant. And then those are the sort of the primitive moments. And then we combined them in some kind of way through these sort of formulas here to give us the rotation invariant moments. Okay, so that means the parts can have any orientation, and the description will still be the same. And then there's also some scaling factors out here, so all the numbers are about in the same sort of size range. Okay, so fortunately for you, all of that's implemented in MATLAB, and there's a function we provided called getProperties, and there's nothing really too special about the code right here. We've got a sort of complex moment that we've developed for you. There's all these formulas down here. That's all the same. Maybe the only thing that's new right here is that there is a built-in variable called pi, which is has the obvious value. And I think the rest is straightforward. OK, one little comment to make is, so there's this BWParem, and there's this BW area function. These are MATLAB toolbox built-ins. And I think the school has about 5 or 6 image processing toolboxes. And there's 108 of you in this class. And so therefore, the licenses are not going to spread very evenly. So we've also built in a number of functions called like my BW area. And they're on the web page. So you should use those instead of the built-ins because of the because otherwise you'll run out of the license servers. And maybe you might even need some other things that you can just look around on the web. Often people make their own versions of the different toolbox programs. Right. Okay, so here's some examples. What we're going to do eventually is attempt to recognize these 3 different classes of parts. We'll have a bunch of images with these parts in them. We're going to try and decide which class they belong to. We've got 3 classes for the sake of simplicity. And for these 3 classes, I've listed here the compactness measure and also the 6 invariant moments that we were just talking about. And if you look at, for example, the compactness, you see that there's not a huge difference between the values right here. So this suggests that maybe compactness is not a good measure to use for not necessarily for discriminating between these, and similarly for C1. Okay, but as you get to some of these other moments, you can see that the values are quite different for the 3 different classes. Okay, and so therefore, it might be quite easy to discriminate between them, sort of around about 0, slightly positive, large negative, or whatever. Okay, that looks like certainly this feature right here is maybe good for, you know, discriminating, you know, this class quite substantially. Usually people don't just use one value, they use a collection of values in what's called a feature vector. So you'll have a description, the object will be a set or a vector of all of these different properties. So here one could take that compactness and the 6 moments and put them together in a vector right here. And then you can go into effectively a different kinds of classification type algorithms or pattern recognition algorithms. And that's what we'll be looking at just next. Okay, but basically we describe the object as a vector, and then we've effectively abstracted away all of the details about the pixels and the position of the object in the image and things like that. Okay, so, right, okay, so you're learning like what metric or something, how do you measure the difference between
those numbers, how do they,
Okay, well, that's really what the next lecture is about, with the new handout that you've just got here. We'll talk about that, but that's the essence of the problem. You've got a set of descriptions for one object and a set of descriptions for another object, and maybe also a class library that says for this kind of part, here's a set of descriptions, and the essence of the question is, are these two sets of numbers, or these two vectors, sufficiently different okay, or sufficiently the same that I could say, oh, this is one of these, or these two objects are different. Well, we'll look at that in just a minute. There's lots of different ways that one can do this, and we'll look at a statistical way of doing that in just a second. Okay, so, well, we've looked at, in this sort of lecture series, these are kind of really the four big issues that we've looked at here. Once we have a thresholded image, you know, how do we find the objects in them? Okay, so we picked that out. And we looked at really a family of measurements that one could use to describe the objects, and as well as the moments. We also looked at a few others, like the compactness and area and things like that. And once we have all of these descriptions of the object, we can put them together and make a feature vector. And this is the input that goes into the next stage, is the recognition stage. So I'll just get that going. But first, we'll have a little interlude. Okay, so you all know that there's a practical assignment coming up, and about half the class has partners so far, and the other half of the class doesn't have partners. So I'm just going to ask you, if you don't have a partner, put up your hand. Okay, nice and high. Now look around. Okay, look around. See anybody you know, recognize, look like sympathetic face, or not too horrible face, or something, I don't know. Nearby. Okay, and then you... Now you know who needs a partner, and then after the lecture, you can meet out. Maybe everybody who doesn't have a partner can meet outside, and maybe some of you will get find partners. It's a bit like dating or something like that, you know? So sometimes I think I'm not teaching you, actually. Particularly with the MSc students, you come from all over the world one by one, and then you go all over the world two by two. I don't know, sometimes I'm not sure if the point of this class, this course here is education or what. I don't know. Maybe it's just a side benefit. I don't know. Okay. So what we're going to do for the next, the rest of this week, is we're going to look at some object recognition techniques. Now there's the techniques that one uses for a recognizing object falls pretty much into five different categories here. And we're really going to deal with just the first one in this particular lecture. And if you are in the take the advanced vision class or whatever, we'll also look at the appearance-based recognition and the geometric recognition as well. And there's a couple of others as well. I'll just say a little bit about it. The properties I won't say too much because that's what we're going to be talking about next. But basically, you have a feature vector which describes the object. That's a set of properties. And recognition is based upon finding other objects that have a similar set of values in the vector. The appearance, rather than doing the abstraction, you basically work over the whole set of pixel values. And the eigenface representation and recognition algorithm is the most commonly known example of that. Effectively build up a statistical model of the picture of whatever it is that you're looking for, and you sort of try to match to the statistics. As I say, we'll talk about that in advanced vision. The third one is a geometric approach where you actually build a mathematical model or a computer-aided design model of the things that you want to recognize. And when you look at the image, you extract a geometric description of some of the features in the image, and you match that geometry to your geometric model. The next is a graph model, where in this case you represent the features of the object by nodes and the relationship between the features by arcs, and this produces an abstract mathematical structure that some of you will be familiar with. And recognition then consists of a mathematical graph matching algorithm where you have a graph of the object, you have a graph of the scene, and you try to find a maximum match between the components of those two graphs. Finally, there's a more recent technique. It's kind of really been developed in the last 10 years or so. It's kind of called the bag of words. It's, for example, it's Google, when they initially did their development of their search engines, used a technique something like that. Basically, for the image analysis, it says, well, if you look at something like me, like a an image of me, and you extract some kinds of little descriptors, little interesting points around my face and body. And for each of those interesting points, you have a little vector of a description. And you may collect 500 or 1,000 of them when you look at me. And stored in the database, you may also have you'll have a set of these, 500 or 1,000. They won't be all the same. Some will be different because my position is different, the lighting is different. But the hope is that enough of these will match up. And it's just a kind of counting exercise that says, how many vectors from my current description match how many of the vectors from my stored database description? And if there's enough of them, then you say, okay, this is a pretty good match for the object and it's likely to be the person. Doesn't depend on matching every single thing right. There was a really fun research project done at Oxford about 5 or 6 years ago called Where's Buffy? And using this technique, they developed a detector for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, so they could, you know, as the video goes past, they could say, oh, here's Buffy, and oh, here's Buffy, and here's Buffy. They used a face detector first, and then they used the bag of words to try and recognize where Buffy was. But it's not all just boring work. Right. Okay, so this is a kind of overview of what we're going to be looking at for the object recognition for today and Friday. It's a probabilistic technique. Those of you who are doing the introduction to applied machine learning or whatever will probably have seen something similar like this. We're going to use a Bayes classifier to calculate the probability that a feature vector that we've just calculated is an instance of a feature vector from a given class. So we have I showed you the three different classes of objects. So we calculate the probability that when we look at an image, that descriptor belongs to one of each of those three classes. And then we just pick the one that has the highest probability. Okay, so we use the Bayes rule to calculate the probability. We need a probabilistic model for describing the objects that are in the class. And we're going to use a multivariate Gaussian distribution. And for this, you'll need a mean vector and a covariance matrix. It's a bit like the mean and standard deviation for those of you used to the normal distribution. It's just here it's multivariate because you have a vector descriptor rather than just a single value. And then there's a question of where did this mean vector and the covariance matrix come from? And we're going to look at a technique for estimating those. Okay, so that's what we're going to do for the next day, lecture and a half. And just to remind you where we got there, we've got ourselves an image, we thresholded it to get a binary object, we located the region, and we measured some properties. So this is going to be our vector right here. And here's an example set of properties. For your problem, you may choose to use other properties. For example, for the practical assignment, it's really about color, because you have to discriminate which so-called robot is which. Okay, so in this case, that feature vector here might be the average red, average green, average blue value that you've got from either the image or the normalized color image, something like that. I mean, the reason why you might do that is because all these robots look exactly the same. They're all exactly the same, you know, size and shape. What distinguishes them is the color, whereas here we're looking at parts that what distinguishes the parts is the shape. Okay, well, what do we want? We want to choose the most likely class, the most probable class amongst our objects. So we've got a set of data. That's our feature vector right here. And C is our class, and we want to choose the class C, which has the highest probability. Okay, so that's the standard notation. Given this is the probability of a given class, having observed that data. And we want to choose the one that's most probable. Okay, we may add an additional condition in that says, well, maybe I might also get other stuff that comes down my assembly line that's rubbish or defective parts or something like that, or two parts that are lying on top of each other and that should have been separated but for some odd reason weren't. So we may also add the additional condition that if the probability of all of the classes is too low, then we just reject that part as an unrecognized. Okay, well, how do we calculate the probability of the class given the data? Okay, this is where we're going to use a Bayes classifier as this, okay, and so we're going to use Bayes' rule. Okay. I'll come back in just a second here. Okay, so just give you the formula for a second. So Bayes' rule says if we want to calculate this probability, we can rewrite it into this probability. Sort of mathematically, it's just kind of a tautology. Okay, so, and the question is, what are these things? Okay, well, probability PC, this is what's called the a priori probability of recognizing the class. So I know coming down my conveyor belt, I've got a mixture of these three types of parts, and I may know, for example, that each of the parts is equally likely to come down a conveyor belt, in which case the probability would be 1/3 for each of the three different classes. Or alternatively, I may know something different. For example, if you go to the health center, the doctor may say, it could be a very bad case of the flu, or it could be meningitis, or it could be something else. And he would know the probabilities of all of these sorts of things. Okay. Of course, when you get to the health center or something like that, there's more to take account of, and that is also the cost associated with the diagnosis. So for example, you might say, well, probability of meningitis is really low, so I'll almost always discount it. But unfortunately, if a person really does have meningitis or whatever, it's quite serious, you need to treat them immediately. So they may say, well, if I made the wrong decision, the cost would be too high. So maybe they adjust their decision making a little bit to take account of that. Anyway, here we're just dealing with pure probabilities. This is the a priori probability of seeing any particular class. This next bit is the probability of observing the particular set of features given a particular class. So this is effectively a distribution that will depend on each class. Each class will be different, it'll have a different set of probabilities, and therefore when I observed a particular set of data, the probability of observing that data for a given class is going to be different. Okay, and this is where we're going to need our multivariate Gaussian distribution as a way of describing this probability distribution. There's other distributions that one could use. We're just going to use that one. Okay, so that's this bit. This last bit down here is the probability of observing this data vector over all possible situations. And well, we don't really know that, but it turns out that the probability of observing this data can be expressed in terms of this. Okay, probability of observing the data for the first class, for the second class, third class, multiplied by the a priori probability. So from knowing this bit and knowing this bit, we can also calculate that bit. And in fact, as we'll see in a minute, for most Bayesian decision processes, you don't need this bit at all here because it's the same for each of the classes. It's independent of class. And so people just tend to not calculate it. It's just a scaling factor. Where are we going to get these PC and PDC? Well, we're going to have some training examples, and we're going to learn from those. We'll see that in a minute. Are everyone happy so far? Just out of curiosity, how many people have seen this sort of stuff before? All right, okay, so should I embarrass the people who say they haven't? No, I won't. Okay, but it looks like most of you have, and a few of you haven't. Okay, well, we're going to model this probability of the data given the class with a Gaussian distribution. In fact, we're going to use a multivariate Gaussian distribution. Here's the case where the dimensionality is 2. This is a case of having two features. Here's a first feature. Here's a second feature. And this is what the distribution looks like. We're going to maybe have, 4, 8, 10 dimensions. You like to work in high dimensional space. So you can't really envisage it so much, but it's the same kind of thing. It's sort of big cluster near the mean of that distribution where the sort of central value is, and it sort of falls off to infinity. It never goes to zero. It sort of rolls off as it goes away from the whatever the center of the distribution is. In our case, we're going to have like an n-dimensional feature vector, so this will be an n-dimensional distribution. Now there will be an n-dimensional mean, there will be an n-dimensional covariance matrix. And we'll assume there might possibly be some correlation between the variables, that the measurements that we're making up here are not necessarily independent. This is another reason for using the full covariance matrix that sort of assumes that there might be some correlation between the variables and helps account for that. Okay, so how do we characterize the normal distribution, the multidimensional normal distribution? Well, we need two things. It's just like with a regular one-dimensional normal distribution, you need a mean and a standard deviation. It's the same kind of idea right here. You have a, in this case, only because it's multidimensional, you have a mean vector. Okay, so this is the average of all possible vector values for that class. And the second is you get a covariance matrix. Okay, that'll look something like this. So this is the two-dimensional case. This is the covariance matrix. It's got the standard deviation for the individual variables down the main diagonal, and all the off terms have the product of the two standard deviations from the, you know, whatever the row and the column variable are, and multiplied by a factor which is called the correlation factor, which says how related the variables are to each other. When one goes up, does the other one go up? Does one go up, the other one goes down, or in which case they're correlated? The third case, if the one goes up, the other one could go up or down or whatever. In that case, they're uncorrelated. Okay, and this factor right here is between minus 1 and 1, and that sort of is a measure of the correlation. Okay, anyway, those are the two sets of parameters that you need. You need a mean vector and a covariance matrix. So let's generalize that to dimension n. Okay, so here's my mean vector for this particular class. Okay, it's going to be of dimension n because I've got n properties. My feature vector is of length n. And here's my covariance matrix. Okay, in this case, it's going to be an n by n matrix, sort of having that same sort of form as we saw right here, except for that it's going to be n standard deviations down the diagonal and all these correlation terms on the cross diagonal. And once we've got that covariance matrix and the mean vector and a measurement vector, a new feature vector, we can now calculate what's the probability of that feature vector, observing that feature vector for a given class by this sort of formula right here. It's a little bit messy, the formula, but for those of you who remember your Gaussian distribution in from a single one-dimensional variable, this is really the same formula, just generalized a little bit to multidimensional case. Okay, so we've got this scaling factor out here. Maybe you'll remember for the one-dimensional case, that's n equals 1. There's the square root of 2 pi in the formula. That's just it right here, except for it's generalized. Maybe you remember the next term is 1 over the standard deviation. Okay, and that's what we've got right here, the determinant of the covariance matrix. If it's a diagonal matrix, it's just the product of all of the variance is down the diagonal, and then you take the square root of them, so this is just the same. And then for the one-dimensional case, it's e to the minus 1/2 of the difference between the variable and the mean squared, and then divided by the sigma squared. Well, this is just the generalization for it. You subtract the mean vector. That sort of gives you some deviation away from the mean. And then there's the inverse of the covariance matrix, which does the kind of scaling according to the standard deviation and also factors out any correlation between the variables. Okay, so this is just the formula. You don't need to memorize it, but it's useful to kind of recognize that it's just the same as effectively the one-dimensional case, just generalized to multidimensional case. Yeah.
The probability should be a number, but I think don't we have vectors in the results? The power, the exponential.
Right. Yeah, okay, so the question is, given that x is a vector, shouldn't this be a scalar? And it is a scalar. And the reason is that there's this transpose right here. So this is a column vector multiplied by a matrix, and then this is a row vector right here. And when the column vector and row vector multiply, it becomes a scalar. Okay, so how do we get our parameters? Okay, well, maybe you know something about the distribution to begin with. That could give you them right away, but generally we have to estimate the parameters. Okay, so we're going to have k samples of our feature vector. Okay, and if n is the dimension of our feature vector, really we should have more than that number. Actually, we could get away with having exactly the right number, but it's not really very reliable to have exactly the right number. You could be dependent upon the noise. You effectively model the noise. So it's better to have more than the number of dimensions that you have. Okay, and once you've got all of these samples, then you can estimate the mean just by averaging all of your sample vectors, and you can estimate the covariance by this formula right here. You subtract off this mean that you've estimated, and then you take the product of these, and you do the product in such a way that this time the product is a matrix rather than a scalar. Okay, so you add up all of these matrices, and then you normalize by how many you've added up. The only little oddity right here is you deal with k minus 1 rather than k up here, and that's because statistically, to get an unbiased estimator, you've already used your data once up here, right here, and so this is not really the true mean, but it's an estimated mean. So the statisticians say to get an unbiased estimator, you should use k minus 1 right here. Okay, so that gives you your mean vector, that gives you your covariance matrix, and the one last thing what we need is we need to have an estimate of the a priori distribution, and we can do that just by looking at our known samples. We can see, watch their conveyor belt or whatever that we're observing. We can count how many samples come from each of the different classes in the training phase, and then we can say, well, we'll use that as our estimate of the probability. Okay, so that's the kind of theory. I'll go through an example right here. So suppose we have two classes. Actually, any questions? Okay, suppose we have two classes, and we want to know, we're going to have a sample. Okay, let's suppose it's like area and parameter. Okay, so it's our data vector. The two parameters, the first is area, and the second is the parameter. We want to have a data sample, and we want to know which of these two classes this new sample belongs to. Okay, well, we need our statistics, so we've got our a priori probabilities. It says class 1 is likely to be 0.6 of the time, class 2 is likely to be 0.4 of the time. Here is our mean vector for class 1, here's our mean vector for class 2, here's our covariance matrix for the two, and I've already inverted them because we need to use the inverse here. Fortunately, MATLAB has an INV function, which you can use for inverting your matrices. You don't need to calculate it yourself. And I've also pre-calculated the determinant of the two matrices right here as well. Okay, so here's our data vector, and here's our two classes. And if I was just sort of looking, at the individual classes, and I didn't have all this other statistics, and I had to make a decision, what would I do? Well, I'd say, well, yeah, 3, 4, 3, 2. It's about equivalent for the area type parameter. That doesn't give me any particular information. And if I look at 10 to 13, well, it's a bit far. 10 to 6, well, it's even a bit further. Well, therefore, if I just had to make a guess, I would say probably class 2. Okay, but really here, we're taking account of the distribution as well, which says not only is it how close is it to the mean, but how likely are these values to vary for the particular class. And we're also taking account of the a priori distribution, which says, well, actually, it's a bit more likely that it would be class 1. You know, if I never even saw the part, never even made any measurements part, but I had to make a guess, what would I guess? I would guess part 1, because it's more probable to be class 1 than class 2. Anyway, so here's our data. Let's work through the analysis. Okay, so our decision rule is it's going to be class 1 if the probability of class 1 is greater than the class 2, because we only have two classes right here. And now, well, how can I calculate this? Well, that's where my Bayes rule comes in. Okay, to calculate this probability, I know Bayes rule gives me that. Okay, and if it's bigger than class 2, that's this. And, well, okay, so my P of X is the same on both sides, so I can kind of get rid of those. So now my decision rule is sort of simplified down here. I've substituted my a priori probabilities in here. And what I see I need to do is I need to evaluate the data probability right here. Okay, well, I get my formula from just a few slides ago. Pull them out. Here's my formula. I start to substitute all of my numbers in, my determinant, my observation, my mean vector, my covariance matrix, and I multiply everything out and evaluate it, get my calculator out, and I discover that the probability is right here. Okay, so that's probability of observing this data if the data came from class 1. Okay, and then we can do the same thing for class 2. And we get this probability. Then we can substitute it back in this formula. So our decision rule says, okay, it's class 1 if this probability is bigger than that probability. And we put everything together, multiply it out. And in fact, probability of class 1 is slightly higher than class 2. So we say class 1. Although in this case, okay, it's barely more likely to be class 1. And if I was building a real kind of part recognition system and I had the two probabilities be so close together, I'd say, this is not a very good situation or whatever. Perhaps, possibly, this is a third part which doesn't belong to either of the classes, or potentially I should go in and look for a different feature. Maybe the data is so noisy I should go in and look for a different property that maybe helps discriminate. But at least for our simplified purposes right here, we're going to just say, well, it's class 1. Okay, so we have a quick little 2-minute sort of problem here. Talk to the person next to you. Okay, time for a vote. Okay, so which is most likely? Votes for class 1, votes for class 2. Okay, so do we do science by voting?
Yes.
Maybe in this class. No, we do not do science by voting. Okay, so we've got our data probability 0.1, for their class at 0.2. And then we need to know our a priori probability and said class 1 is 3 times a priori 1 is 3 times as likely as a priori 2. And we know that the a priori probabilities have to sum up to equal 1. So we, from that we can calculate that the a priori probability of 1 is 0.75. The a priori probability of class 2 is 0.25. Substitute back in here. And we can put them there. So this is 0.075 and this is 0.050. And the probability of class 1 is bigger. So therefore, we get class 1. Questions? Yeah?
What does star thesis over there give to
me? I don't know. Anybody have a good Latin background here? Anybody study Latin? Yeah, somebody translate? Oh, right. Oh, I see. We'll get back to you on that one. All right. Okay, while we're waiting for Google, we've got a little bit more MATLAB here. This is the MATLAB for calculating that function that we had way back here. There's our function right there. Fortunately, we've got a little MATLAB that's got it all packed in. We've got our data vector, we've got our mean vector, we've got the inverse of our covariance matrix, and we've got our a priori right here. We subtract it off, take the length, square root of the determinant of covariance matrix. Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a good translation here. No?
A bit legal terms.
Hmm?
I'm not a lawyer, but stare decisis means you have to abide by legal precedent, effectively.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay. So this is a decision based upon legal precedent. And but oh, by the way, here's other factors that you may want to consider if you go to appeal or something like that. Or you know, so maybe there's a law class in here previously. Okay. So anyway, there's a bit of MATLAB all built in. Remember, they've got these three dots here, okay, which says that means that the formula that you're calculating continues on to the next line right here. And otherwise, I don't think there's anything different. I guess maybe we haven't encountered too much this little caret right here, which is the exponential operator in MATLAB. And otherwise, it looks normal. Okay, when you're developing your classifier, really you should be a bit systematic about how you actually estimate the parameters used in the classifiers. And otherwise, what you risk is that you train exactly on the data, okay, but maybe the data has some idiosyncrasies in it, and therefore you're sort of training to the idiosyncrasies rather than producing a kind of a classifier which is more objective. So people have tried to address some of this problem, and one of the ways that they address it is by this sort of methodology. You split your data into three different sets. Okay, well, a training set, a validation set, and a test set. Okay, so the test set gives you the true performance, or an estimate of the true performance, and the testing is done on a set of data which is completely independent of the training data and training and validation data. So if we had to estimate our covariance matrix and our mean, we would estimate them using the training set, and then we would evaluate the performance of how well our classifier is working, how many times it correctly classifies and how many times it makes a mistake, by using data which is from completely different samples. If you're also, in our case right here today, we're using a batch training algorithm where we just take all of our training data and estimate the mean and covariance at once. There are also sequential training algorithms in which as you get more and more training data, you train and train a bit further, and then you have the question of when to stop. And that's where this validation set comes in. It's a way of telling, you know, when to stop training, when to estimate when you've stopped, effectively extracted all the useful information out of the training data and are now at risk of overtraining, which is effectively fitting your model to this particular set of data rather than to the generalization of what the data ought to be. So there's a validation set that helps you stop overtraining, okay, with this. Anyway, but in any case, whenever you do any of this training data, you need to have more training samples than you have properties. So that's back to this formula where I said you need to have at least k samples, which is bigger than the dimensionality of your problem. Okay, and the rest of the examples that we're going to use here, actually, I'm going to, I didn't have enough training samples, so I'm just going to ignore all of this and go right ahead. I'm going to train on the data, and then I'm going to use the data again for a test set. Just for demonstration, but don't do that in the practicals or in real life or whatever. I just did it for simplicity here. Okay, so right. Okay, so as a final comment, okay, so because we're doing this batch mode training, we can merge the training and validation sets together. Okay, and in the examples that I'm going to come up presenting in the rest of the lectures on Friday, where there's only going to be four samples for each of the different classes. Okay, and because of my rule that you got to have more samples than your dimensionality or problem, what that means is that we can use at most three properties. Okay, they're from all the different properties that we have coming up. So we're going to look at a classifier that works over the different classes we've got with our training samples and our three properties. And that's where we'll finish today. Any last questions? Okay, well, I'll see you on Friday. For those of you who are still looking for partners, you can sort of hang out in front of the lecture hall and maybe find a partner.
Fix that. I'm willing to help if is there anything I can do to ignore the calls. I'm willing to have just to modify them and then to send them back to you.
I'm not sure. You mean like it's a mistake?
Yeah, I think it's a printing issue.
Okay.
How can you like modify them so the next time you print them? So I'm willing to help you.
Yeah, okay, which works? You mean like inside these boxes?
Yeah.
Oh, if you can find the words if you just go to the course webpage.
Yeah, I know, but I was thinking maybe I can help in modifying slides or something, reformatting, so when you print them, just go.
No, I want it like this.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, so you have to do something in the lecture to exercise. It helps your brain.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, it's done deliberately.
Oh.
But thank you for the offer of help, yeah.
Do we need to send you an email?
That would be good. I've got a little bit too much to do right now, so just email me would be great.
Okay.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.